Rory Bell is a great friend of Cornhill. He's here nearly every year. Some of you will have heard him teaching in the past. But we've just felt that the material that Rory's given on a number of different things, but particularly just on this handling Bible narrative and stories, was just so useful and so helpful. We felt that we wanted others to get a chance to hear it and to share in it. And Rory, we're really grateful to you for coming. And looking forward to this session now. And just before you come, let me pray together and ask God's help for us. Lord, we thank you that you have given us the great and grand and wonderful story of your Son and of the gospel. As we think of the way that the word one-to-one has been used all over the place to bring people to that word, we thank you that you have given us your word, the scriptures, to open up and to bring the delights of your heavenly story right here to earth into people's lives. And so we ask now that as we come to this last session of today, that you would give us fresh vigor and attention and desire and appetite to learn more. Help us and help Rory as he speaks to us, that we might better handle your word of truth and so bring glory to our Lord Jesus Christ. And we ask it in his name. Amen. Glory.
Well, good afternoon. It's good to be with you. I'm a South African, so it's going to take you a while to get used to my accent. We've been living in the UK for 10 years. We've discovered that if you pay the government enough, they let you stay. And so that's why we're still here. My wife's got a Scottish grandfather, so he was born in Partick, which is not too far from here. And I've got some Scots in me somewhere along the line. Yeah, is that right, Terry? Very good. This is not my usual gig. My usual gig is as Director of Training for TNT Ministries. TNT Ministries was founded in St. Helen's Church, Bishopsgate, out of a need to see children taught the Bible more faithfully. And really what we do is we do two things. We provide Bible teaching resources, mostly for Sunday schools via our downloadable resources. And then for 40 Saturdays of the year, roughly, I'm somewhere in the country or the world trying to help adults to teach the Bible to children. And it's a delight for me to be with you this afternoon because it means that more than 10% of my audience is men. So I don't normally get to have so many men around me on a Saturday. I don't know why that is, gentlemen. Why is it that we have so few men involved in children's ministry? I really don't know why. Generally in our church, I say I think it's because I never need to look for women to be involved in children's ministry, probably because women are more spiritually mature than men, or because they understand the strategic nature of children's ministry, and then the men are there like a shot. They say, that's not true, and then they're there. So what I'm going to be doing with you today is just to, and Thursday, just to explore some ideas of how we might tackle narrative, because I'm convinced that the amount of energy and time that goes into a Sunday school lesson ought to be comparable to what goes into a sermon. At the end of the day, it's exactly the same thing. The age group is different, but it is essential that people get to grips with the scriptures in order to teach the scriptures. And so what we try to do very hard with our material is to force people to study the Bible. So we don't provide scripted resources. We don't allow people to sort of look through the handbook on the way to church on a Sunday and then teach the Bible. We're just saying that really every single lesson you teach is a lesson to be lived before it's a truth to be taught. And unless you marinate your soul in that text and you are moved by that text and you apply that text to your own heart, you should not have the audacity to try to teach it to others. And so one of the things that we do in our training days is about five different days that we run, but one of them is a day dedicated to narrative. And I'm just going to be giving you two sort of sessions out of that day as we think about stories and narrative in general, and then on Thursday we're going to be dipping into different elements of the stories and how we should use those in our preparation in terms of understanding the text itself. So I think it's fair to say that we all love stories. People all over the world love stories, and that's why there are just so many novels and films and plays and biographies and autobiographies and histories of peoples and cultures and travel journals. We all love stories. In fact, when the iPad was first launched, it really does look like a clunky old thing now, doesn't it, when you compare it to what's out there now? But when it was first launched, 2 million units were sold in the first 60 days, and those 2 million units downloaded 5 million books. I mean, the thing's not really even designed to be like a Kindle, and yet it is, and 5 million books, more than two per unit, because we love a story. There's something about the human nature that loves a story, and there's great power in a story. There's great power in a story. A story is something which engages both the mind and the heart. It's a powerful conveyor of truth, but at the same time, it can be a powerful conveyor of error. Now just think about it as you sit and watch a film, as you get yourself caught up in the story, how sometimes you are even moved to think in a way which is counter your own conscience or counter your own morality. My wife and I are great fans of the series House. I just love the fact that he's so candid. He could basically be a South African. And what was striking was there were two episodes that followed one another, and it's quite interesting to see that there's always a backstory and a sort of moral angle to the whole thing. In the first picture over there, you've got Chase, the young doctor, who switches the results of the African dictator who was hell-bent on going back to his country to commit genocide. And so Chase doesn't want this to happen, so he switches the test results, which results in the guy dying. And House knows what's going on. He doesn't report him, but it's obvious from the situation that House absolutely doesn't agree with what he's done. In the very next episode, his mate, the oncologist, Wilson, basically provides assisted suicide for one of his patients with advanced stage of cancer. And House justifies it. So there you go, two opposites in terms of, you know, where you're being pushed in terms of your morality. Essentially the same thing. And yet you feel justified in the one and not in the other. That's what films do. That's what the story does. It has the power to move you to think in a way which is counter your own morality. How many of us have watched these romantic films? You know, there's this absolutely gorgeous woman. She's married to a very simple, ordinary sort of bloke. He's non-communicative. He doesn't take much of an interest in her life. And then the Sylvester Stallone figure appears in the office. And he's gorgeous. And he takes an interest. He pays her attention. And isn't it true that we almost will the affair, don't we? We sort of feel in our conscience, you know, she really should have got together with him in the first place. That is the power of a story. And so in that sense, a story is a double-edged sword. The story, a well-told story, a well-narrated story, has the ability to take rid of boredom, to engage your audience in terms of their hearts and their minds. And yet at the same time, it is absolutely critical that the story be teaching the big idea of the passage. That's one of the great responsibilities of a place like Cornhill, as we are teaching people to become orators. That you can teach someone to become a good orator, but if they're not teaching the Bible faithfully, you're actually doing the gospel a great disservice. There are many, many people who speak winsomely, who speak persuasively, and yet they tell what could be conceived to be untruths. Politicians come to mind, but let's not talk about politics, okay? And so it's very important that we are getting the central message of the Bible, that we are teaching what the big idea or the main thrust or the theme of the text is. What postmodernism has done is it's pushed what we might call the marginal reading of the text, where we might pick up one little detail in the text and make that the main aim. And go off on a tangent on that. I mean, we've seen that this morning. Alistair's mentioned to us the fact that, you know, Philemon is not a treatise on slavery or against slavery. That is incidental to the actual passage. That's not the main thrust. That's not the author's intent. And yet postmodernism is telling us that we cannot know what the author's original intent was. And so it's critical that as we come to think about telling stories well, that we make sure that we are teaching the Bible faithfully. That's very important. I'd much rather have a boring Sunday school lesson with a story that's badly told, but at least it's faithfully told. But let's think about how we might better prepare ourselves as we think through stories. Of course, the Bible is, in one sense, one massive storybook. It's a collection of 66 books written by about 40 authors in three different languages, written in three different continents over a period of about 1,600 years. 40% of it is narrative, it's stories. The title of the book is good, He Gave Us Stories. And, you know, in that sense, it's unique. We don't find another writing like that anywhere in the world. There isn't another book like the Bible. The Bible, although it is 66 books, holds together phenomenally as a story. There is such internal integrity to the Bible, it is astounding. And I suppose in one sense, you've got to try and think through how the Bible works in terms of what I would call a narrative arc. So where the story starts and where it ends. And of course, our story starts in a garden, it ends in a city. If we had to summarize the story of the Bible, well, someone said you could call the summary of the Bible is, kill the dragon, get the girl. That is essentially the story of the Bible. Kill the dragon, defeat Satan, and rescue the bride of Christ. That is the story of the Bible. And yet within that massive arc, there are whole lots of little stories, little narrative arcs. And as we come to look at a passage, as we decide on a passage for a particular lesson, as we decide how we're going to break up a particular book in order to teach it as a series of lessons, that becomes very important to work out where are we going to start the lesson and where are we going to end the lesson. Where does that work? How does that fit? What does the story look like? And so we need to be thinking in terms of narrative arcs. And there is nothing like the Bible. There is no other religious writing anything like the Bible in terms of its ability to tell a story, in terms of it being able to do it over so many thousands of years through so many authors and different continents, different languages, and yet the internal integrity in the Bible is absolutely astonishing. The Quran doesn't come close to it. The closest thing you get to a complete story is the story of Joseph, and then it's mostly been nicked from the Bible. We've got to remember that Muhammad was Johnny come lately to the party, wasn't he, at 650 AD. The party's over, and here he's trying to invent another religion. So the Quran can't hold a candle to the Bible in terms of its integrity. Now, of course, the Bible's not simply a story. It's not just a history of the people of Israel. It's not just to provide light bedtime reading. The Bible is what God uses to make himself known to us. It's a revelation. God, of course, reveals himself in at least three different ways. He reveals himself generally through creation. And so the psalmist says, we've got to go back one there. This clicker, that's not mine. There you go. Did you see that? Can you go back one for me, please? Well, there you go, or two or six. what does it say there? For Psalm chapter 19, verse 1 says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The heavens declare the glory of God. I've been watching David Attenborough's Our Planet. It's an astonishing piece of work. And what I just don't get is every time I hear the word evolution, I just think to myself, are you guys nuts? Such amazing design. I mean, the world, creation is screaming to us that there is a creator. The silent witness of the world around us is absolutely deafening that there is a creator God. And so, of course, Paul says in Romans chapter 1, verse 20, he says the following. He says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. And of course, he speaks, of course, in Romans chapter 1, that people suppress this truth about God, which is what I'm hearing as the commentary of this fantastic fish eagle getting a fish out of the water, you know, as you hear about this evolution stuff. And you say to yourself, hang on a second. You are suppressing what is blatantly obvious to everyone. So God reveals himself in creation in that way, but God also reveals himself through his written words, through the Bible. There's an interesting verse in Amos chapter 3, verse 7, which says, surely the sovereign Lord does nothing without revealing his plan to his servants, the prophets. It's an interesting juxtaposition there. You've got the sovereign Lord, who can do anything he wants, without consulting anybody, without seeking approval from anybody. He is the sovereign Lord, and yet he does not act in the world without first revealing his plan to his servants, the prophets. I think that's remarkable. It's teaching us what we would call propositional revelation. The Bible is propositional revelation. God tells us what he's going to do, and then he acts, and then he tells us what it means. He's done that throughout the Bible. So this is so different to Norse mythology. Norse mythology, you have an event, and then you have people trying to explain the event. So they'll attach a story to the event. Yeah, the revelation is part of the story. So God tells Abraham exactly what's going to happen to Israel. He tells him in Genesis chapter 15 already. He says that your people will go into exile, that they will be into slavery, that they will be in slavery for 400 years. But I will rescue them by my mighty arm, and then I will bring them into this land. And what happens? Well, hundreds of years later, it plays out exactly the way that God said it would. In fact, there is a sense in which Genesis chapter 3 is the announcement of the gospel. God has told us beforehand precisely how the world stage is going to play out. We see the proto-gospel given to us in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. So it's propositional revelation. God makes himself known. He tells us what he's going to do. He's been very, very clear in what he's going to do and how he's going to act in the world. And then, of course, finally, God reveals himself most perfectly in the person of Jesus. And that passage that was read earlier today as well, so it's Hebrews chapter 1. Sorry, if you can just go back to that. This doesn't seem to like text. Have you noticed that? What does it say? Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1 to 2 says, "In the past God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways, but in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son." So God has spoken in various ways. He's spoken through burning bushes that don't burn. He's spoken through prophets. He's spoken through all kinds of strange antics of the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken most clearly through his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, the exact representation or imprint of his being. Now, in this session and on Thursday, we're going to be spending our time thinking through that second aspect of God's revelation, the idea that God has revealed himself through a written word, which we are privileged to have in our own language, to be able to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest. And of course, 40% of the Bible is narrative, it's stories. So we need to get our heads around what a story looks like, some principles of stories, how we understand stories, how we might present stories in an exciting way. And the Bible contains an enormous number of very exciting stories. Very well-written stories, well-crafted stories. And I think if we're teaching any of the Bible stories in a way which puts people to sleep, we really are doing the Word of God a great disservice. So let's think then in principles of stories. And for the vast majority of what I'm going to be doing today is thinking through a secular book, really, which is about stories. And it's a guy called Christopher Booker who's got a book called Seven Basic Plots, Why We Tell Stories. Christopher has spent 35 years of research exploring stories from all over the world in many different languages and cultures. He's examined the stories and he's tried to categorize stories, and he's come up with what he would call seven basic plots. And he's really just saying that all the stories in the world could be categorized in one of seven basic plots. Now, why are we using a secular author in order to try and think through stories? Well, because I think that sometimes we don't do enough hard work at thinking of the Bible as a story, as thinking about the individual stories within the Bible as stories. And when we don't think about it as a story, we then fail to engage with the characters. We fail to think about things like character development. We fail to think about things like plot. We're going to explore all of these things on Thursday as well. Elements within the story, how the story moves quickly, how it slows down, how it emphasizes things. Where's the foil? Where's the protagonist? Where's the antagonist? And I think that the stories become so much richer, and they help us to understand the stories better when we start engaging at this level. It's the same when it comes to biblical metaphor. I think sometimes we don't engage enough in biblical metaphor. So, you know, when the psalmist writes in the Psalm 131, verse 2, when he says, "Like a weaned child with its mother, so is my soul with you," he's not suggesting for a moment that God is a woman, which, you know, some people would go down that route. I mean, we've got a bunch of nutcases in Kingston, where I have an office, who are at the God My Mother Church. You know, they believe that God is a woman. Now that text is not saying that, but we must engage with the metaphor. If we in our minds picture a weaned child nestling in the bosom of a mother, safe and secure and all of that, well, that's what the psalmist is saying. That's how I feel with God. It's not that God's got breasts. It's that I am feeling that secure. And in the same way, I think we don't engage with stories the way that we ought to. And so I think it's helpful to take a leaf out of Christopher's book and to think through plots in stories. And so that's all I really want to do today, is just explore the seven different plots to get us thinking about this subject today. of narrative. The first plot that he speaks about is overcoming the monster. Now, this is quite a common plot. It's generally defeating some sort of force that threatens. If I had to represent that visually, it would probably be something like that. There's a force that's oppressing. There's a force that's causing distress. And something needs to break through. Something needs to overcome the monster. So this is going to be the vast majority of your Hollywood films. It's going to be Star Wars. It's James Bond. All of those. In the Bible, we might think about stories like David and Goliath. Goliath is the force that threatens. Someone needs to be the hero. Someone needs to break through. And that's how the story is told. Maybe another story might be Moses at the Red Sea. He's there. There is no hope. They're being surrounded by, they're surrounded by mountains and seas, and the Egyptian army is approaching, and they need to be rescued in some miraculous way. And so when you tell that kind of story, of course, there is a climax, there is a build-up. You see the hopelessness of it all, and you spell out the hopelessness of it all, and then we see the miraculous rescue for what it is. The second type of story is the quest. The quest is typically a group that's set off in search of something. They generally find it. Examples of that might be Pilgrim's Progress or Indiana Jones. It's that kind of film. If I was to depict that graphically, it's a linear, it's just a line, it's just an arrow. It starts in one place, it finishes in another place. The finish is itself the climax. That's where the story ends, and they've achieved their goal. So perhaps the wise men in Matthew chapter 2 is an example of those who've gone on this quest, gone on this mission, and found their goal as they worship Jesus. Perhaps the 12 spies in the book of Numbers, going on their mission, going out on a quest to survey the promised land. Perhaps the entire journey of Exodus from the Exodus itself to the promised land is itself a great quest. They're starting in one place, they're ending in another. There's a lot of other stuff that goes on in between, but they eventually do get there. There's the voyage and return. A voyage and return is generally a hero that journeys away from home. They go somewhere different. They come back having experienced something that has changed them, mostly for the better. So things like Gulliver's Travels, The Wizard of Oz, Lord of the Rings. There's a lot of time that's spent exploring character development, isn't it? I mean, Lord of the Rings I found very difficult, really. I think it's helpful when you go into a film that your wife drags you to realize that it's a trilogy before you start watching. Okay, I think that's quite helpful, because when you sort of thinking to yourself, goodness me, there's a lot that's got to happen in the next 5 minutes when I suspect we should be out of here. And if I have to see Frodo's face again, I think I'm going to slap him, okay? And then you realize it's a trilogy, and you think to yourself, goodness me, okay. But there's a lot in that film, and even when it's all over, there's just a lot, doesn't it? It just takes forever to end. Because they're exploring character, how the people have changed, how their characters have developed because of what they've experienced. We see those kinds of stories in the Bible too. I might depict that in this way. It's a V shape. They've gone somewhere, they've returned. And the reason why I've displaced that from the start to the finish, by the way, Christopher Booker doesn't illustrate them in this way. I do it because I've got a dyslexic son and I find diagrams quite helpful for my own brain. Perhaps I'm a bit dyslexic, I don't know. But they've gone somewhere, they've returned, but they're different, they're displaced. Something's changed. And we see stories like that in the Bible. We see Naaman, he is changed. He journeys to another country, he experiences something, he comes back, he's different. You see the same with Naomi in the story in the book of Ruth. She goes away, she comes back, she's different. In fact, even her name changes, doesn't it? She goes away, meaning pleasant, comes back, bitter. She's different because of the voyage and the return. The sending out of the 12 disciples as they go casting out demons and they find that there's some things that they can't do. That whole learning experience for them is a journey, a voyage, and a return. The next type of plot is the comedy. This is not a ha-ha kind of comedy. It's not that kind of comedy. It's more classical comedy. And really, in this sort of thing, is that it's not necessarily a funny plot. It's generally some sort of misunderstanding that happens between two characters that keep them apart for virtually most of the film, and eventually, at the end, they get together. You know what I'm talking about, gentlemen. If you've had to endure anything like Notting Hill or Pride and Prejudice, for goodness sake, those sort of long-suffering films. I'm an engineer by training, so I like to sort things out quickly. You can say, just get together and sort it out, but they take 3.5, 4, 5, how many hours is it? 6? I don't know how many hours it is. It's ridiculous. That's how long it takes. Every time there's a misunderstanding, there's a friend who hasn't passed on a message, there's a missed phone call, the battery's flat on the mobile, I don't know. It just keeps them apart all the time. Now, I endure Pride and Prejudice because I get to watch the Bourne trilogy once a year, starting on my birthday. And yes, it's only the trilogy that's worth watching if you're a purist. But there is this idea of comedy. They're being kept apart. We see stories like that in the Bible. I would think that the Balaam's donkey incident is a comedy, not because you've got a talking donkey, but because if you look at the geography of the story as he's trying to curse Israel, you've got to think about the geography. There you've got Israel on the east of the Jordan, on the plains, ready to cross the final hurdle, which is the Jordan River, to land up in the promised land that God has promised they would be in since the time of Abraham. That's the final hurdle. And yet somehow, this bloke thinks that cursing Israel will prevent that from happening. I mean, it's comedic, actually. And what happens is he goes up one hilltop, curses, nothing happens, it becomes a blessing. Goes up another hilltop, curses, nothing happens, becomes a blessing, and does it a third time. It's comedic. We all know what the destiny of Israel is, and so we see that what he is doing, he's trying in vain. In that sense, it's a comedy. There's another kind of plot, which is that, comedy is something like that. That's basically Pride and Prejudice plot. Shortest point between two points is A to B, and then you've got to go through all of that to get there. It's bonkers. Okay? So that's the kind of thing with a comedy. The next one is a tragedy. Someone is tempted in some way, maybe it's vanity or greed. They become increasingly desperate, they become trapped by their own actions or their desires or their vices, and usually in the climax they die. Unless, of course, it's a Hollywood film, in which case they have a happy ending. So examples might be Hamlet or The Devil's Advocate, something where someone is caught up in some sort of vice and it spirals downwards. You might depict it in this way. It starts off very well. It ends very, very badly. We can think of stories like Saul. Saul is a good example of this. It starts kind of well. It ends very badly. The story of Samson's life starts off well, ends very, very badly. It's a tragedy. Most of your, if you take the book of Judges as a whole, that is true of the book of Judges. You've got the spiral. But at the end of the day, it ends badly. It starts well, it ends badly. There are also rebirth narratives, which look different. Obviously, in this sort of plot, the hero is captured or repressed in what seems like a state of living death, and it seems as though all is absolutely lost until finally they are miraculously freed. So Snow White is an example of a rebirth story, as is most of your Die Hard films. Their shape would be like this. No, it wouldn't be like that. We've gone ahead again, haven't we? Could you find the V for me? Thanks. It starts off in a particular way. Things get worse. They seem absolutely hopeless. And then miraculously, things are changed. And things generally end much better than what they started. That's to be a true rebirth plot. Okay? So you might think about the sacrifice of Isaac as being an example of a rebirth plot. He starts off at one point. Abraham's got great faith in God. He takes his son up the mountain. He's going to sacrifice him. All seems hopeless. All seems lost. And then things end much better. And then you've got the commendation, "Now I can see that you fear me." So that would be a rebirth narrative. Finally, there is a rags-to-riches narrative. And that's exactly as it suggests. Examples of that would be Cinderella, Pretty Woman, I suppose, or all 27,000 derivatives thereof. If you had to depict that, you might depict it like that. Things for the main character start off really badly. There is absolutely no hope whatsoever. But through some sort of intervention, they are taken to a point of fame. So stories in the Bible that might look like that could possibly be Ruth, the story of Ruth. She starts off as a Moabitess. She's a nobody. She's a widower. She's a widow in Israel. She's a childless widow in Israel. And yet Boaz is the one who liberates her. And ultimately, it's seen really as the liberation of Naomi, isn't it? Because the child is said to be Naomi's. Perhaps David, the shepherd boy, could be considered a rags-to-riches kind of story. He starts off as a shepherd boy. There's the incident with Goliath. He rises to fame and fortune. Perhaps the story of the demoniac in Mark chapter 5 is another great story. There's someone who is in a hopeless situation. He's bound by chains. No one can help him. He's naked. He's no one can do anything. Absolutely hopeless. He has an encounter with Jesus, and he's dressed and in his right mind at the end of it. So there you go, 7 basic plots. I found it very helpful in terms of our own ministry and our own lesson preparation to be thinking these things through, to be thinking about the story as a story, to be thinking about when I come to a passage or to divide up a series for a particular series of talks, where's the story going to start? Where's the story going to end? What does that look like? What does the plot look like? Where's the climax of the story? What am I going to build up to? What am I going to build away from in terms of the telling of the story? When am I going to speed things up? When am I going to slow things down? And then, as I said on Thursday, we'll think through a little bit more in terms of the actual characters and their development. Now, Booker concludes in his book that the 7 plots are wired into our subconscious. He'd go as far as to say that he refers to them as being sort of latent in our minds. They're latent in the minds of the authors as well as in the minds of the readers. And I suppose that's why it's so hard, isn't it, for Hollywood to come up with a plot twist these days. That is a plot twist. Essentially, a plot twist is one that goes away from the 7 plots which we are so used to seeing. And so I've just found that an incredibly helpful tool in terms of my own understanding of a passage, in terms of thinking through how I might tell stories to children and what that might look like. And I think it's probably worth those of you who are still doing workshops in particular passages, if you're dealing with narrative, to think that through, to take those plots in these next couple of days when you've got time, to think through, well, what plot would I ascribe that to? Sometimes the plots might not fit very neatly. This is just meant to be a tool to get us to engage with stories as stories. All right? Good. I hope that's been helpful. Do I pray? Or do we ask questions? Are there any questions? We've got a bit of time. Yeah? Yeah? Anybody got any questions? Yeah?
I think you find, this is an obvious question, multiple plots within one particular character, or one character situation within a portfolio.
Well, that's the thing, you see. So we're dealing with lots of different stories sometimes, aren't we? So sometimes, I mean, if you take Joseph's life as a whole, it's almost comedic, isn't it? So when you think about Joseph's life as a whole, it starts off with him having these dreams that his family will be bowing down to him. And yet we go through this relentless cycle of just when we think he's got to the top, he gets plunged to the bottom. Then he gets to the top, then he's plunged to the bottom. It's comedic in that sense. And yet if I was to preach one particular passage, maybe that plot would look slightly different. And so that's what I'm really just appealing to you to think about, is to think about the plot of a particular passage as we're preaching it. And I think I found this enormously helpful to think about how I break up a series, to be honest with you, to try and think through the plot. I'll talk more about this on Thursday as we try and think about ways in which narrative arcs work. But in terms of multiple plots within one small narrative, probably not. I probably need to settle on one. But you know, you take the story of Samson. I mean, we dealt with Samson as a Sunday school lesson. We dealt with the whole of Samson's life in one lesson. Why did we do that? Well, because I've only got 216 lessons in the four-year curriculum for that, for 3s to 11s. And I don't think Samson's worth more than a lesson. I honestly don't. And when you deal with Samson's life in that way, is you find this downward spiral. You find that he was a man who, with the three things that he should have obeyed, he should not have cut his hair, he should not have been near drink, he should not have been near anything dead. And as you go through the whole story of his life, those number of chapters, you see him disobeying at every single point. And yet, what is the end? The end is that God uses him to rescue his people, despite his depravity, despite his ungodliness, despite his self-centered prayer at the end of his life. He prays for the sake of his eyes which were the problem in his life, and yet God uses him. So I think there's massive application there for us, but I wouldn't see that if I was just going through Samson's life piece by piece. Does that make sense? I think there's value in going through Samson's life piece by piece, but from my context, I want to say, I want to deal with the whole thing together. And in that sense, the whole of his life, in my mind, would be a tragedy. Does that make sense? Yeah? Anybody else? Yeah.
And it's very helpful, I think, thinking of the narrative as sort of propositional revelation.
Mm.
And yet part of the challenge is that we read narrative purely propositionally.
Mm.
So we miss it as a narrative.
Mm.
So have you got reflections from both teaching, training, kids, working with churches? How can we ourselves, but then serve our congregations, to really read narrative, not just to mine it for the propositional content?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, and that's the problem sometimes, and we had it in our group as well, where sometimes we can so rigidly put our three-point sermon onto the narrative that we actually lose the flow of the text. So particularly in children's ministry, I'm trying really hard with our resources to say to people, tell the story as a story. Then go and play a game which is related to the lesson we're trying to teach. And then discuss what the story means. So I've sort of separated out what does the Bible say from what does the Bible mean and what does the Bible mean for me. Now, you get children's ministry resources where they're just telling the story. Okay? And they're so obsessed with telling stories that they are embellishing Bible stories because they want to make them fun. So you'll get something like, there once was a shepherd, we'll call him Tom. No, you won't. Tom had 100 sheep, curly, whirly, fluffy. I mean, it's just ridiculous, isn't it? And these people, I think, are doing this because they don't really know how to teach the Bible. So they feel I've got to fill 45 minutes, if the preacher's going on for it, maybe 50, 60 minutes, in telling a story by embellishing it. And so I want to have the freedom in my children's ministry to tell the story in a concise way, which is memorable, but I don't want to embellish the story beyond what the Bible gives me. And then I want to discuss what the story actually means. Does that help? So I'm not stripping the story of its joy by going through it as though I was going through a commentary. That's what I don't want to do. And so perhaps in a congregation setting, we could be a bit more creative in the way that we allow stories to tell themselves. So one thing that we do quite a bit, especially when we've got large chunks of narrative, is to read it together as a congregation. And you know, the NIV, well, if you're not using the NIV, but you could use any Bible in this way, the NIV has a dramatized version, which is fantastic because all the parts have been broken up. And we generally do this on Good Friday. So Good Friday, we will read a vast chunk of Passion narrative as a congregation. People will be appointed to be different people within that narrative, and they'll stand up and say things. And it's incredibly powerful when you have the entire congregation shouting, crucify him, crucify him, because they are the crowd. And I think we get driven along by the story then. And then someone gets up and explains the story. So there are ways in which we can do that. I think we just need to be a little bit bold in the way that we do that. And you're absolutely right. You think of the stories as stories. That's the whole point of what I'm trying to get across today. And I've had to use a secular tool to try and get me there. And I'm happy to do that. It's sort of the tool like an archaeologist might do to sort of brush away to see detail on an artifact. I'm using Christopher Booker as that little trowel or the little brush to uncover the, unlock the story for me. And the first part of that is to discover the plot, really. Yeah. Right, one more question? Yeah. Yeah.
So saying, you know, you've been given a story, so tragedy, you look at the example.
Yeah.
Very tragic story. So I've given it the label of tragedy. Mm.
Yeah. And I see what happens is with this, it's often like this when we do preparation for study, isn't it? So you might say, okay, this is the big idea of my passage. You then come to study your passage in a little bit more detail, and you come back to your big idea and you say, it doesn't really quite fit, does it? So you modify your big idea, then you come back to your passage again and you work it, and you say, it's not quite the same. It's exactly the same. You might say, okay, this is what I think the plot is as a first reading. That's what it looks like. You start working the text a little bit more. You say, actually, I'm not quite sure that's right. You come back and you bring it back. It's to help with thinking through the story as a story. More than that, I can't help you with today, but certainly Thursday, as we think through characters, development, plot, that sort of thing, it'll become quite clear. Okay, is that helpful? Good.